Okay, the conscience. We hear about it. People talk about it. Bible has a lot to say about it. Let's think about some basic facts. A lot of people would have their definition for a conscience. I've given you two or three here. Number one, a conscience offers moral guidance, and it can affect the decisions people make. Now, that's not a complicated definition, and I think it is overall a very good definition. If we want to simplify it a little bit more, the conscience helps people to decide what is right and wrong. One or two have at least defined it as the divine alarm system. Not everybody would see the conscience as something that is God-given, but Scripture does present it. That is part of what we are. God built a conscience into us. Sometimes people do some good things with it. Sometimes they do some bad things with it. But God did make that part of our psyche. Now, if it's used correctly, Romans chapter 2, verses 14 and 15 tells us that it can be very, very effective. And this is an interesting illustration. If I want to go ahead and get somebody lined up for that, this is where you may remember that in Romans chapter 1, in Romans chapter 2, we've got information about the Jews and the Gentiles. Paul gets into Romans chapter 3, and he said that all, that is the Jews and the Gentiles, are under sin. And in this section, Romans chapter 2, verses 14 and 15, he's talking about the Gentiles. He says the Jews, they did have that written law from God. They had the Ten Commandments. They had 600 plus commandments total. But the Gentiles also had some information that they were pulling from. Romans 2, 14 and 15. Anybody there? And want to read it for us. All right, Mom, we'll start with you. Thank you.
For when Gentiles who do not have the law by nature do the things in the law, these, although not having the law, are a law to themselves, who show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience also bearing witness, and between themselves their thoughts accusing or else excusing them.
Okay, Paul says at least two times in verses 14 and 15 that the Gentiles did not have the law. They didn't have the book, so to speak. But even though they didn't have the law, was their conscience at work? Yes. And how was their conscience operating? What was the standard? If they didn't have the book, they didn't have the law, how was their conscience able to operate and operate reasonably well?
Their hearts. Their conscience.
I think you said hearts, right?
Hearts.
Okay. They had that. They had at least a sort of a basic outline. They had at least some core principles. They had a general understanding. You may not know, you think about a child, for instance. You think about a young person growing up, and maybe he or she has reached the age of 15. Now, at that time, would you say that they know as much as a 70-year-old? Well, obviously not, unless there's something very unusual. But even though they're not, you know, 65 years, or 55 years, I guess, I should say 55 years past the 15 that we're talking about, they still have sort of a framework there. And they have not learned as much as a 70-year-old has, but they can sort of start plugging some things in. Well, I had that experience, and I was taught that this was wrong. And that's kind of like the Gentiles. They didn't have the 70-year-old guide as far as the Jews, but at the age of 15, so to speak, to use that illustration, they had enough, and they were able to have enough where God said that was going to impact their eternal state. So that's very interesting. All right, looking at point number 5, illustrate how the conscience can be a terrible and completely wrong guide.
It can be seared.
All right, we're going to see that a little later from Paul and his writings to Timothy, so people can so foul it up by making some bad choices. People can ruin their minds. We've seen that with drugs and sometimes with alcohol, different ways to just destroy that part of the body. So that's a good beginning point. What else? Let's ask the question again. How can the conscience become or be a terrible and completely wrong guide?
Being informing your opinion by what someone else does.
Okay, or even says. We allow other people who are not good sources to help form or maybe revise, refine our conscience, and we pick the wrong thing. Anything else?
In that reading that you did in Romans 2, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
According to my gospel, if those secrets that we have within ourselves, if you let that be your guide, that would not be good.
That's true. And to maybe add an additional point there, a lot of times what goes on the conscience, that's not visible to other people. Now, you might see the effects of that. You might see how a conscience plays out as far as the decisions that somebody makes. But sometimes what goes on in the conscience, it is a secret thought. people, might consciously they want to do something. I should do that. I need to do that. And maybe they never do it. Or the reverse is certainly true as well, where people conscientiously either they're kept from doing something evil or they want to conscientiously and they don't. So good, very good as far as verse 16. All right, let's tie in with number 5, what we have down there in number 7. List wrong ideas have about the conscience. The number one answer there might be, let the conscience be your guide. Well, you need to be careful with that. If it's not been properly trained, if the conscience is seared, as Marcia pointed out just a little bit ago, that's not going to be good. What else, though, could we put in there as far as a possible answer? Wrong ideas about the conscience.
You let that, your conscience is okay with that, but when it comes down to the moment of birth, and it's okay to kill this baby, and people, their conscience says that's okay, I'm trying to link it together, I don't know if you can understand what I'm saying, but that's not okay.
No, it is not okay, but that is, as you say, there's, I don't know that we've got half the country that believes that, but maybe at least a third. Or 20%, I would say. So there is definitely a significant number of people who have that idea. And it's just sort of, it's the most convenient thing. It needs to be a woman's right, to choose. And that's where they are conscientiously. It's some people have made the point that over the last couple of years, been a lot of hollering about follow the science, follow the science, follow the science. Well, if you take that as a principle to live by, and you look at abortion, what do you have going on within 8 weeks? Or you can go back up to about 5 weeks. You've got eyebrows being formed, and I have to go back and look at it again. I don't remember exactly where all the parts start forming in, but you got fingers, and you've got toes, and you've got the heartbeat, and just within 6 to 8 weeks, I mean, it's amazing. And then you get the fingernails, and you get the toenails, and you can tell sex/gender of the baby, all those things. And science tells you that you're not dealing with fetal tissue. It tells you that you just don't have some mass of something, and you go from a non-human form to immediately after birth, you change to what is a human being. So at least for some people, the conscience says up until the time of birth, abortion is fine. You're not going to kill a person. So it can get twisted sometimes because of political ideologies, sometimes because people just want nothing more than a vote. And that's really sad, but it's messed up. Anything else?
Well, I guess I see it in a way that we use it as an excuse to justify what we're doing.
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah.
With last week's lesson of the feelings, we kind of put feelings and conscience from a worldly standpoint together, mm-hmm. that we're not putting our trust in God as our guide, but ourselves and our feelings.
Yeah, and that's a very dangerous road, especially if we're going to kind of angle off for a different reason this morning as far as looking at people and the majority. That's how their conscience guides them. If the majority, so again, it could be back to abortion, or you can pick almost any other social issue, and that's how they let, well, everybody does it that way. So, if it were just me, I might not do that, but this is groupthink, this is the majority of people. So all this stuff goes together, and it's kind of circulating there in Paul's life. Brent?
Think about the time he judges, everyone knows what's right and what's not.
Yeah.
It feels good to do it.
Yeah, pretty much. And you can see there, I think we can maybe add one little tidbit there. If you have the majority headed in a certain way, do you think that sometimes will guide a person's conscience? It's tough to stand against the crowd, but more on that a little bit later. All right, so let's move down a little bit more to point number 9. Can two people have completely different conclusions? I think I got a conscience in there regarding the same matter. Can they have a different conscience as far as facts are just the same? We're going to draw from 1 Corinthians 10. And see what we've got in verses 27 to 29. 1 Corinthians 10, 27 to 29. Who wants to be a reader? All right, Bonnie, we're going to go to you.
If any of them that believe not bid you to a feast, and you be disposed to go, whatsoever is set before you, eat.
All right, now let's stop right there. Paul says, here's half of what I want to tell you. Somebody invites you. I remember this was a culture where if you saw meat on the table, there was probably at least a 50-50 chance that the meat had come from where?
From
an idol, or idol feast. So the Christian obviously is concerned about that. Some were bothered by that, some not so much. So Paul says to the Corinthians, if you go, you're invited to this party, going over to somebody's house, and they got a nice chunk of meat on the table, do what? Don't ask. All right? If you don't ask, then what's that going to do to your conscience, hopefully? If you don't know what's a problem, you might wonder a little bit, but if you don't know what's a problem, then chances are you can
eat up.
You can eat. I'll take seconds, right? That's good. Send me home with a doggy bag. But I can eat the meat. It's not going to be a problem. All right, so that's what he says about the conscience. And let's read a little bit more.
But if any man, did you want me to finish that verse?
Yeah, through 29.
Whatsoever is set before you eat, ask you no question for conscience sake. But if any man say unto you, this is offered in sacrifice unto idols, eat not for his sake that showed it, and for conscience sake, for the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. Conscience, I say, not thine own, but of the other. For why is my liberty judged of another man's conscience?
All right, now here's where things get a little more complicated. Somebody learns, and maybe it's the host, and he's asking you about it, or maybe it's a third party. And this comes up. I've got this dinner invitation. I'm going to go over and eat. Let's just say it's a third party. I'm going to go over and eat at Stan's house, since he was looking at me. All right, and Steve says, since he's close to me too, Steve says, don't you know he's an idolater? Don't you know that he was just down to the meat market? Don't you know that you're going to be eating meat that was sacrificed to idols? I wouldn't do that. Are you really going to go to Stan's house? Now, as a Christian, how can I respond to that? That's not a hard question.
I don't know where he got the meat, so yeah.
Oh, okay. That would be one possible response. I don't know, therefore I'm going to go. Now, how do you think that's going to make Steve feel? If he's got a conscience problem as far as meat in an idol's house, he's going to have a warm, fuzzy feeling, or it's going to be maybe troubling for him?
But he was gossiping about that guy.
Maybe.
He could go and not eat the meat. Just tell him.
Yeah, but if it's really going to trouble Steve, then as you look at verses 28 and 29 of 1 Corinthians 10, what's Paul say? Better to avoid it, so I don't trouble Steve's conscience. Steve?
Where does the phrase, if I don't know, it can't hurt me, where does that fall?
Well, I think that would be... you, in this case, not knowing about it, not discussing it with you, it's, I don't know, this kind of goes back to what Marcia was saying initially, I don't know where he got the meat, so 1 Corinthians 10:27, it's not going to hurt me, I'm going to be okay. So there are some times where you simply don't want to know about some things. Now, that could be probably a whole separate class and a big discussion. But there are times where it's better just to...
Ignorance is bliss.
Yes, ignorance is bliss. And as the old saying goes, let the sleeping dog lie. So we have to go back and research as far as where all those neat little sayings came from. But I suspect that some of them are based on at least some Bible principles. So we can come back to you, but I'll take Stan's hand.
Well, if there's a group of people, especially going to be there, and Steve knows or believes that this was meat offered to idols, but nobody else in the group does, isn't Steve better off to keep his mouth shut, stay home?
Well, certainly, as far as attending. But it looks like Paul's maybe even going a step beyond that, where Steve somehow gets involved with the discussion, maybe he initiates a discussion, and he's really bothered by that. I did put down some examples here. We can see if we can come out with some of those. But it does go back to what we're talking about as far as the general principles that Steve was talking about. There's some things that it's better just not to discuss. Let the sleeping dog lie. Ignorance is bliss sometimes, those kinds of things. Especially if you know. Now, we're not trying to deceive people. We're not trying to lie to people. But you can stir up trouble. You can create issues where that just does not need to be done. And you have that principle, I think, especially in verses 28 and 29, 1 Corinthians 10 coming out, where go, don't make a big deal of it, and, be grateful that you're able to get good food. But, Carol?
Well, we're all going to Stan's, and Steve says this, so we're not going to Stan's, so now Steve has made us not be nice to Stan?
Yeah, Yeah, and that's why I say you can start complicating some issues. So we can't always avoid the third party, but there are times where we can. And if we know that something is going to be a conscience issue for someone, then why bring it up? That's not loving behavior. Yeah, you may not be able to get yourself out of the discussion. And if it does have to be something that's discussed, or if it is brought up, then deal with it and deal with it in the best possible way. But always try to deal with that in a loving way. But be sensitive to the fact that there are going to be some people who can be troubled in their conscience by decisions like that. Jeff?
I'm just thinking about conversations that I have with my kids where stumbling block conversation. There might not be something inherently wrong with something, but if you know it's a stumbling block for somebody, it might be in your best interest not to do that or to go or to learn what the situation is, because we don't want to be a stumbling block. Now you can also use that hopefully in time as a teaching moment to the person who has a stumbling block to try to correct the whatever the situation is. But maybe not this exact situation, but just things in general in life. So I don't know, my mind is going there.
And I think that's an excellent point, especially from a very wise parental point, where kids, if you're trying to teach them to be a good influence, say, look, you know, this may not be inherently wrong, but your friends, some other people are going to see you do that, and what do you think that's going to do to their conscience? As far as, you know, I thought you were a good person. I thought you were a Christian. I was thinking about becoming a Christian. But now my conscience has been affected. My feelings towards you have been affected as well. But my conscience, you know, you just do some things that trouble me. So it does have really significance at every stage of life, but especially with young people. Okay, let's move down a little bit more and see what we've got as far as a couple references. We're going to pull these from Acts 23 and verse 1. Then we'll skip over to Acts chapter 26 and verse 9. And these are key references as far as the basis for the class. Here's Paul on two different occasions talking about his life and his conscience. Let's pick up with Acts 23, that opening verse. That's Steve. Thank you.
Then Paul, looking earnestly at the council, said, "Men and brethren, I have lived in all good conscience before God until this day."
Now, if you're a Christian and you heard Paul say that, you go back 2,000 years in time, "I've lived before God in all good conscience until this day," what would you be thinking?
So everything you did, including when you were a
Christian. Yeah, that's rich, isn't it? Yeah. You know, we're going to see when we get back into class, Lord willing, week from next Sunday, that Paul really did some nasty stuff to Christians. And apparently it troubled him as far as his conscience. I mean, he knew that he'd been forgiven, but still there's some things where it's easy just to continue to beat yourself up over what you've done. Even though the Bible says don't do that, that can be a human frailty. But Paul looks back and says, when I was doing all that bad stuff, my conscience was bothering me or not? Not. You know, I was able to put people in prison. I was able to vote against them. I mean, I was able to chase them to foreign cities. You know, I was kind of the number one persecutor. And I think people probably would have said you were the number one, I mean, by far, you were the best persecutor of the church, which at the time that might have been a title that he wanted, give him a plaque for that. But once he becomes a Christian, he looks back at that, and that would have been a time of embarrassment, a time of shame. You know, I'm sorry. I mean, I can't go back and undo that. Some people have died. Maybe some people were still in prison. But at the time, my conscience did not bother me. Do we have people like that today? I mean, you can pull out the news just about 7 days a week and see some people who have done some things, and you have to ask, what was their conscience like? We haven't, again, gotten down to Marcia's point yet, but it looks like it's been seared. It looks like there's just no good moral judgment left, either in the person or at least for the circumstances that they were involved in. I mean, I just kind of scanned the headline, but just the other day, maybe the last 24 hours, there was somebody who took a gun and murdered all the family members. It was like killing five people. And you're thinking, how do you do that? You know, bad enough to do it to strangers, but you go in and you just wipe out some close family members. You know, the conscience is just sick. All right, let's take a look at Acts chapter 26 and verse 9. All right, Gary, to you. Thank you.
I myself was convinced that I ought to do many things in opposing the name of Jesus of Nazareth.
Okay. All right, that was kind of the basis for last week's class, and Shana was right as far as seeing the connection between last week and this week. But Paul said, And I don't want to get too far into that because there's still some key words that we want to look at. But number one, how many things did he feel like he had to do conscientiously?
Many.
Now, somebody might say, well, you know, I don't support the cause, so I'll speak out against it. I'll do some things that will show my lack of support. But that's not what he says. I felt compelled. And we'll say more about that, but I will give you this little tidbit. And I'll tell you again in 2 weeks in case you forget. But anyway, we've talked about day, D-E-I, that word which means must. Remember John 4:24, you must worship. We use a triangle illustration for this word. That's the word that Paul uses there in the original text. He felt like he had to. He felt like he was required. He felt like he was obligated conscientiously. Now, you think about a person. Well, let's just explore that a little bit. Where or what kind of things do you see today where a person feels so strongly conscientiously that they pull out all the stops?
Conscientious objector.
All right. Here's a person who says, look, I'll go to the hospital and wash bloody bed sheets. And there have been some people who have made that choice. Or maybe I'll be a medic out there in the field, but I will not pick up a gun. I will not go out and either take the life of another person or, drop a bomb, on them and, scare them, whatever that might entail. But they are conscientiously opposed to that, and they will do everything that they can. Bob, wasn't it you that was telling me about the guy who shot off his toe? Okay. You want to tell that story?
No, went to basic training. He came home. He had orders to go to Vietnam. So he goes out on his front porch and calls the ambulance. When he hears it coming, he puts a shotgun in his big toe, blows his toe off.
Yeah. It was a guy who didn't want to go to Nam. But can you imagine? But when you think about people who are opposed to something, I mean, they will go to great lengths. Now, there it wasn't so much, I don't think, a conscience issue. It was probably just he didn't want to go. But, I mean, if somebody is really, really opposed to it, they will, go down to the mat and fight for it. Anything else as far as an example? I'm going to start with Carol and Bonnie. We'll come back to you.
Well, a lot of times you hear of these people that do mass murders and run around. They think God told them to do it, so they go do whatever they thought of.
Yeah. There are people who get some strange ideas, sometimes religious ideas, sometimes not. But they think there are voices telling them to do things, and conscientiously, I mean, just like Paul, I acted in all good conscience. So go before the judge, and as the jury is listening to them, they will say, yes, I still think this needs to be done or that had to be done. And it's really strange, but if people have that conviction, it can be scary. So if the conscience is improperly trained, if it has gotten derailed because of bad influence, all kinds of bad things can happen.
Well, I remember when I was a kid and the subject came up at our dinner table about World War II. My dad was in World War II. And he rarely talked about it, but he did say that he had to really work with his conscience of the Japanese people because there was such hatred for him during the war. But he had to really work at it to get past that.
Yeah. Well, there is. When you find people that are exposed to things like that, I would imagine, as far as a more modern pillar. Thanks, Jeff. Well, what about police officers? I would imagine if you talk to nearly any police officer who has served for, let's say, 5 or more years, they will be able to kind of go through their life, their cases, the things they've experienced, and say, I've got some conscience problems. I've been put in situations which were almost impossible to deal with, had to make some choices. And it's not just there. You can find that in virtually any line of work. And that includes church work. People make decisions, and conscience-wise, you can look at parents. Conscience-wise, they have to make decisions with their kids. And there can be, in the later years, they look back and say, my conscience bothers me because of the choices that I made and so forth. All right, let's take a look. I don't want to cut anybody off. Anybody else? Okay, let's take a look at Titus chapter 1. Titus chapter 1 and verse 15. A person's conscience may be a bad guide for this reason. Mom, to you.
Do the pure things... To the pure, all things are pure, but to those who are defiled and unbelieving, nothing is pure, but even their mind and conscience are defiled.
All right, some translations we use the word defiled, some other versions we use the word corrupted. Now, we probably use or are a little more familiar with corrupt than defile, but how can you corrupt or defile something? Maybe let's start there instead of actually thinking about the conscience first. How can you corrupt or defile something?
Keeping the wrong company.
Well, let's put that on hold for just a second. Let's think in general. How can you corrupt something?
Add something negative to it.
All right. You, for example, would, I don't know, if you're cooking, you know, you put your breakfast biscuits in the pan this morning, you mix it up and thought, all right, let's throw in some vinegar. Well, chances are, you know, your blueberry biscuits were not all that tasty with a dose of vinegar. Jeff?
I think that just computers nowadays, but people create viruses.
Yeah.
And they corrupt, and harmfully try to corrupt other people's things.
Yeah. And if it's corrupted, what's that mean? Let's use a computer illustration. Obviously, if you got your biscuits, you know, coated in vinegar, they're not going to be tasty. You're going to want to throw them out. But with a computer, if it's corrupted, your files are corrupted, then...
If you can steal information or destroy your computer.
Yeah. So if you corrupt your conscience then, you defile your conscience, what's true?
You don't make good...
Well, let's use a computer illustration. Junk in, junk out. So God has given you a conscience. You can have that properly trained. But if you defile it, if you corrupt it, if you ruin it, you're going to come out with bad decisions. You're going to come out with moral thinking, which if it doesn't put you on the wrong side of the law, it's probably not going to give you the best possible life. You're going to make some very bad choices along the way. So Paul warns the young preacher about that. All right, then we have in John chapter 8 and verse 9, this question as we think about the conscience. Can age affect the conscience? Now, I don't remember anybody ever raising that question based on John chapter 8 and verse 9. This, for me, was kind of a new thought in going through this study. But let's take a look at the verse and let's give some consideration to the question. John 8, verse 9. Gary, to you.
But when they heard it, they went away one by one, beginning with the older ones, and Jesus was left alone with the woman standing before him.
All right, here's a woman who's caught in adultery. She's brought to Jesus. And the accuser should have been brought as well, but that's kind of another story. And Jesus, you know, writes some stuff on the ground, says a little bit, and then the people leave. It's only him and the woman after a little bit of time. But who leaves first?
The old people.
The old guys. Why? Now, the text doesn't specifically say why, but you can kind of, with the information that's there, figure it out.
They knew better.
Yeah, they knew better, and chances are... Because of what Jesus said, and what did he say? Let him that is or without sin or sinless, there you go, cast the first stone. Well, the younger guys might have needed a little more time to process that, but the older guys, let's just say that we're dealing with people who were 20 and 60, to make the illustration simple. You live 60 years. Do you think you can look back over your life fairly quickly and see some things where, you know, I shouldn't have done that either, and I really messed up then. You think you can do that if you live 60 years, even a relatively decent life? What about the person who's only 20?
He still
knows it all. The list might not be quite as long, though. So you can see the 60-year-olds are thinking, yeah, all right, you know, I can understand the point. If it's let the one who is sinless, you know, cast the first stone, that's not going to be me. So, all right. And then you get down to the lower ages. So when we ask the question in point 16, can age affect the conscience?
Yes.
Yes. Now, would we say that it always affects the conscience? No. This is sort of like Proverbs. It can be a general principle. So you will find as people get older, sometimes they are a little kinder. They mellow out a little bit sometimes. That doesn't always happen. But you will find people who, you know, look at their life and say, well, I certainly wasn't perfect. Or when I was young, then what?
Dumb things.
Okay. Well, that would be a good frank way to put it. But I did some dumb things, so I had my chance. And thankfully, God was gracious to me. Maybe some of the people were merciful to me. And now they need their time to grow and mature as well. So... age is sometimes important when it comes to conscience. Now, that doesn't mean that we let people do whatever they want, but we do want to bear that in mind. Anything that you want to pick up as far as additional thought there, Jeff?
Think of the age. I think of my grandma Martin. She lived down south, and when I was younger, she was taught up in a certain way. She's a great Christian woman, but she still had some racial tendencies because of how she was brought up. And now that she's got older in life, why she still struggles with that, because she doesn't bring it up anymore, but she used to bring up comments when I was younger, and we had conversations. But, I mean, sometimes the influence of how you're brought up definitely affects your conscience, and you have to figure out how to overcome those things, depending on what they are, obviously.
Yeah, we're getting further and further from that as far as a number of older people who grew up, especially down south, with a lot of the segregation. I mean, time changes things, and the law has certainly changed things as well. But we have had several people in this country, and they're still around to at least a certain degree, that grew up with that. And conscientiously, that was it. You know, racism is right. We've talked about this community being a sundown town, and how if you were dark-skinned, then you needed to be out of town. And that was the way it was. People lived by that policy, and they did so in good conscience. And then as time went by, things began to change. People began to see things in a more biblical way. And there are a lot of them that suffered some conscience problems. It was like, well, why couldn't we see that before? I mean, you know, they're a person just like I am. They're made in the image of God. Their skin might be a little lighter. Their skin might be darker. We were on the wrong side of that. And that's good, that if people are able to re-educate the conscience, to learn what is more consistent with God's will. And that's a process for a lot of people, but sometimes those lessons are very, very difficult to unlearn, just because you are exposed to that and it gets sort of set in concrete, so to speak, throughout those formative years, and then it's reinforced in the adult years. So another good illustration. Thank you. That it? Okay, let's go down and see what we've got down here as far as 1 Timothy chapter 4, verse 2. This is going to get us to where Marcia was. All right, Lois, thank you.
By means of the hypocrisy of liars, seared in their own conscience as with a branding iron.
Anybody ever seared some of their flesh? Maybe you were ironing and, got just a little warm. What happens when you sear flesh?
Ouch.
Well, yeah, I think that's where it begins. Ouch. But what else is true? What happens with that seared flesh? Is it soft like a baby's bottom?
Red.
All right, it turns hard, right? You know, it burn, obviously, and it does hurt. And when you think about that applied to the conscience, seared flesh, hard, a hardened conscience, what's that tell you? What's that kind of person like? A seared conscience.
Not easy to change.
All right, that would be a good beginning point. It's going to be very difficult because, again, just like the sear on the hand, it's just kind of locked in. Jeff gave us a good illustration of that as far as racism. If you're steeped in that, that's what you're taught. That's what the culture reinforces. Your conscience may not be completely seared, but it's going to be pretty strong, pretty firm as far as those convictions. What else?
It's very hard to talk to them to try to make them change their mind.
Yeah, if you're trying to speak to someone who has a seared conscience, it's almost like talking to a brick wall. You just find it almost impossible to get through. What, though, can change? I'll take your hand, Steve, and then we'll come back to the question.
When I think of sear, one thing I think of is when you're cooking, you sear mm-hmm. the meat to keep in the juices, so searing keeps things from easily going back and forth.
Yeah, what a superb illustration. In the case of meat, you really can't unsear it, can you? I mean, once you've seared that side, I mean, you can kind of poke it with a fork, and you might be able to sprinkle some water on it, but it has definitely been affected, and it's going to be very, very difficult to do anything with that. You might be able to put some barbecue sauce on it or tenderize it a little bit.
That's the reason they do it, to keep the juices in.
Yes.
Whatever.
Yeah. Now, isn't that, let's take that one step further. Wouldn't that be, everybody has seared some meat, right? Back in the old days at Ponderosa, this is how they taught us to cook steaks. They said, throw it on a hot grill, and you sear it for a couple minutes. Doesn't matter the doneness. You could be from rare all the way up to well. Sear it for a couple minutes, flip it over, and about two more minutes, you sear it that way. Just for the reason that you described. You want to seal in those juices. So, and then you just move it to a more medium or lower heat, depending on where you want to go, and then finish cooking it out all the way up to well. So you can try that if you're a steak cooker. And I know it's a little wrong for the time of year, but anyway, just kind of keep that in mind. But if you take that illustration as far as meat, searing it on both sides, and you think about that in terms of the Christian conscience, what we want to do, can't you see the application? We want to take the juices. We want to take the gospel, and what do we want to do? We want to sear it inside. We want to harden that conscience and harden it in such a way where we say, these are the convictions that God wants us to have. These are the convictions that we are going to have. And we want to make sure that they don't seep out. We want to make sure that we don't lose the good juice, so to speak. So, neat thought there. Thank you very much. Okay, let's go back here and see what else we've got. A lot of material for not enough time. Offer illustrations for this type of conscience. Let's do that as well, taking us down to 18 and 19. A seared conscience. Bonnie gave us a good one. We kind of ended up with her as far as the last answer. It's difficult to talk to people. What else as far as a seared conscience? What about the illustration of abortion, where you can show people? I mean, they say, look, we can give you pictures. We've got all the scientific data as far as, you know, 4, 5, 6, 8 weeks. These things are happening inside, the body of a woman. I mean, we do have a child. But if you don't want to believe that, then you can see the evidence. And what's your reaction?
I'm thinking of the gubernatorial candidate that said that the heartbeat that you hear
is fake. Yeah, wasn't that rich? I mean, it is...
Talk about a seared conscience.
Yeah, it's just unbelievable what people will say, and sometimes in public. Anything else as far as a seared conscience, Bonnie? And then Stan.
There's always an alternative for them.
Yes.
I've had many conversations with my sister, and we are complete opposites on this issue. And her issue is, she was a school teacher, and her issue is, but these kids who are not wanted, they are so much better off because they're up in heaven. I mean, she's always got a comeback. And she said, don't you believe that? Well, yes, I do. But how about the person who murdered that baby? They're not going to vote so well on the judgment day.
Yeah.
And the people who believe that way, I mean, I went as far as, we've had many conversations, there's no getting through to her. When people believe this, and she, her conscience is seared on it.
Well, I don't have it on the sheet, and this wasn't in the mind when I prepared the material, but Jesus' parable of the sower. Can you see a seared conscience in those four seeds? Sower went out to sow. Where does the first seed fall? Well, it's on the concrete, right? It's on the ground that can't be, you know, it's like the asphalt. You can't penetrate it. Would you say that you have a person who has a seared conscience, if that's how the Word of God is affecting them? I mean, it's just lying there, can't go anywhere. Yes. So there are a lot of different ways to find that idea of a seared conscience, not only in life, but also in Scripture. Stan, to you.
Well, two things. One, there, I see a difference between a seared conscience and one that was never taught.
Oh, that's true. Now, you could be, and I think you're probably on board as far as my thinking as well, you could have one who was never properly taught, and that results in a seared conscience. Or you could have one who was taught, like Jeff said, and that sears a conscience. So there are a couple ways to get there.
Right.
Okay.
Well, and then I was thinking of the person with the seared conscience. I think that you'll probably find that a lot of people who went to war came back with a totally different view of things, or at least the view that they had when they went is now no longer valid because it's been so disrupted by what they saw during the war.
Yeah. Well, and we've got Iraq that's a little closer to us as far as time-wise than Vietnam. So I'm going to pick Iraq, but just because they had a lot of car bombs. If you are defending an area and you've got, you know, you're one of the guards out there, or you're, someone who has a gun and charged with maybe stopping people if they get past the guards, some kind of secondary post or something, and you've got people driving in, and maybe you can see that there are kids in the car. You've got to make a decision. Is this someone, you'd think that they would be able to see all the warnings, and, you know, maybe there were some audible warnings and sirens. I wasn't there, so I can't, give kind of a 1, 2, 3 as far as how it worked. But I do know that if you're on that guard gate, and you have somebody who's coming, and they're not stopping, it is your job to ensure that they do not make it into the compound. And that's rough. If we were in the service, I can remember as far as we had some mornings where people, the drill instructors, they played games with the recruits. They would come down and bang on the door at about 2 o'clock in the morning, and you had a young airman out there, and it was his job to, he was the door guard. Now, the door was locked, so there's no way that they could get in, so that seemed a little senseless, but anyway, it was just one of the tests that they did. The guy would be banging on the door and saying, let me in, I gotta be let in. Well, the procedure was you check for ID. The guy needed to have a military ID, and the ID needed to match up with his face and everything. Well, they tried different tricks. Sometimes the ID would be from somebody else. Now, if you've got a guy who is light-skinned and the ID shows somebody who's dark-skinned and you let him in, well, you got what they called recycled. You got sent back to the beginning. And it was really a judgment call. Sometimes, you know, it was a test that you could pass, and sometimes it made it almost impossible. You know, 2:30 in the morning, the light might not have been the best, and if you waited too long, you could get recycled. Go off to get somebody else, you could get recycled. So, it was kind of a luck of the draw. Anybody else bothered you, that kind of thing? Did they, okay, so 1, 2, Stan had that, Don? Oh, all right, so we all kind of had the same experience. And, it was just, like I say, just kind of incredible there. I was going to go on with that, but I'm going to let you take the last point, Stan, and then we'll close it out in a different way.
Well, I was in the military also. One of the things they told us, I worked on the flight line, and they said, if anybody approaches that aircraft and you become suspicious, or if they should get on the ladder as if they were going to the cockpit, you do everything you can to stop them. And I remember them saying, even if it was one of the air police. Now, that in my mind was a real struggle, because now you've said that an authority figure must be stopped. And I was brought up to obey authority figures. And so that created a problem.
Yeah, it does. I'm going to take an extra minute to finish out the illustration. When you're having to make those decisions on the spot, it was kind of 50-50 as far as letting the guy in, and either, sometimes it was right, sometimes not. And you can imagine circling that back to what you have in Iraq. You're having to make those same kinds of instantaneous decisions, and it's not somebody pounding at the door, but you've got somebody actually moving towards you, and you've got to decide, do we open fire? And if you do, and there are children in the car, if it turns out that they are innocent civilians, maybe they're fleeing from somebody, and they're thinking that you're going to be the place that offers safety. That's going to be a conscience issue. So what you're talking about earlier, as far as people having, to live with some of that stuff, it can be very, very difficult. All right.